So thanks for coming, everyone. My name is Jensen Harris, and I'm the Group Program Manager of the Office User Experience Team. We're the team that builds the user interface for all of the Office programs. So why am I here today? Well, Office 2007, which came out a little over a year ago, introduced a radically different user interface for Office. How many of you have used Office 2007 who are here today? Good. So what I'm going to be here today is not to talk about the next version of Office, but actually to talk about the story of how we built Office 2007. And I'm going to do it not so much by talking through bullet points, but through showing some prototypes, telling some stories, and telling you a little bit about the design process that we used. So hopefully it'll be kind of informal and kind of fun, and you guys will be seeing stuff today that literally has never been seen outside of Microsoft. These are prototypes we've never showed anyone before. So just so you sort of have in mind sort of how long the Office 2007 product cycle was, it started back in August of 2003, which is when I joined the team. That's right after we shipped Office 2003 and we started thinking about Office 2007. And it took us just over 3 years to get from sort of the initial, let's start working on this, until it was shipped or released to manufacturing, as we say. And I'm going to start the story back in August of 2003. So put yourself in a 2003 mindset. We're going to flashback back to summer of 2003. And when people talked about Office in the middle of 2003, there were two words that came up again and again and again. Good enough. The version of Office I have is, well, it's good enough. People only use the same 5% of Office. Everyone only needs a few features. Everything I ever needed was an Office 95 or 97 or 2000. That number actually keeps moving up. But there's sort of this sense that Office was done. Yet, whenever we went and talked to actual people who used the product day in, day out, they showed real frustration, and they told us a different story. They'd say, well, I know there must be a way to do this, but I can't figure out how. Or, Office is so powerful, I just don't feel like I can use it very well, and I'd be better at my job if I could. And what we began to realize in the months leading up to Office 2007 was that the user interface of the product was actually failing our users, that we vastly overestimated how well our current user interface was working. We added new features to the product every version, but honestly, hardly anyone found them. Hardly anyone used them. Office seemed increasingly complicated every year. People would say the next version is just more complicated than the previous one. And people actually were optimistic about the possibility of getting things done, but they assumed that we would never change Office. Office was done. And so this is sort of how we felt about good enough. And so we made it our goal in Office 2007 to get rid of good enough. What would it take to get past good enough? That was sort of our mantra. So before we look forward at Office 2007, I always think it makes sense to look backwards to see how you got there. And so I want to take you through a trip through ye old museum of Office past. And as we start at the oldest exhibit we have in the museum, be careful not to get too close to it, we have Word for Windows 1.0. Anyone in here remember or use this version? Wow. Sorry. No. This was the first version of Word that we ever built for Windows. It was designed to run on 640 by 480, and it had a set of menus and it had two toolbars. And if you drop down the format menu at that time, this is what you would have seen. That's right, 5 items on it. So it's pretty easy to understand how this program works when it has such limited functionality. The first reasonably successful version of Word for Windows was Word 2.0. And this was a version where we actually were able to dig up the first specification that we ever built for, or that was ever written for Word 2.0. And it was written late in Ronald Reagan's second term. This is a product that was designed back in 1989. Yet look at the top level menu bar. File, edit, view, insert, format, tools, table, window, help. Exactly the same menus that are in Office 2003. Think about how much the world of computing changed between 1989 when this program was designed and now. Yet the user interface, the menus were locked in place at that point. Now you'll see as we move towards more and more recent versions of Office, make sure that you look at the user interface additions that we add in each version and the number of toolbars. So by Word 6.0, we've already jumped from 2 toolbars to 8 toolbars. And as we make our way into the 32-bit world of Word 95, you'll see that we're already up to 9 toolbars. Now, if you wonder how come we only went from 8 toolbars to 9 toolbars on Word 95, well, it was actually a split release. A very small part of our team was working on Office 95, while the much bigger team was working on Office 97. Now, there's one UI feature that was introduced in Word 95 that I think personifies the modern word processor, which is red squiggle underlining for spell checking, which is a great feature. But like I said, most of the team was off working on something else. And that something else was the circus known as Office 97. Wow, look at all the UI that we added. So we went from 9 toolbars to 18 toolbars. We added toolbars on all sides of the screen. Drag and drop stuff everywhere, hierarchical multi-level IntelliSense, we've got it all. And of course, the most loved and brilliant piece of UI component we've ever added to Office, or maybe any program, the lovable, useful Clippy. And Clippy, the Office Assistant, is such a good piece of UI that it's actually the only piece of UI that ever made its way sort of into mainstream comedy.
Now, come on, Bill, you really got to buck up. You're actually getting off easy compared to what the government did to Clippy, that annoying paperclip icon that pops up on your Microsoft Word software all the time. This is true. Their government's been pretty tough on Clippy. Check out this chilling footage of what the government did to Clippy earlier today.
So there was a lot of UI in Office 97, and although it was a blockbuster release, one word we found started being talked about with Office every time the press wrote a story about Office, starting in Office 97, and that word was bloat. Office is bloated. The Office apps are bloated, bloated with features. And part of this is traced directly to the new UI components that we added in Office 97. And so in 1999, we started work on Word 2000. And Word 2000 began the march to do what we called, get it? Reduce the perception of bloat. And so the first of the features that we did to reduce the perception of bloat was something called IntelliMenus. And the way IntelliMenus worked was this. Instead of actually reducing the complexity of the product, well, we could hide some of it from you. So what we do is we would take a random set of menu items and we would hide them. And then if you hovered over one of the menus for long enough or clicked the little arrow at the bottom, then we would open up the menu and show you the rest of them. And even better, we don't open them up at the bottom, so you can't just scan halfway through the list and then hit it and scan the rest. We actually put them in the middle, so you have to go all the way back up to the top and scan all the way down again. And even better, we'll keep changing the things that are on the small and the long menus based on your usage. The computer will auto-optimize it based on your use. And so that was IntelliMenus, which was not the best thing that we ever did. We also, in order to reduce the perception of bloat, instead of having the two toolbars that stacked nicely on top of one another, we rammed them up into one line, even though no one's monitor had enough room to show them on one line. And what we did was we chose a random set of them based on usage to throw away, and you had to click the little icon on the side to find the rest of them. So this was inherently very unpredictable. It led to lots of confusion, and it didn't actually reduce people's feeling of complexity with Office at all. Honestly, all it did was make the screenshots look a little nicer. So that was sort of where we were in Office 2000 in terms of reducing the perception of bloat. And to be honest, it didn't really work. And so when it didn't work, we did whatever user interface designers do when they run out of ideas. And that's, well, we invented a new rectangle, introducing the task pane. The task pane the little rectangle on the right, basically said, you know, we've given up on menus and toolbars. No one can find any of the features we put in them. They're too bloated. We tried hiding some stuff. That didn't work. So now let's just add another place to look for commands. And that was the task pane. Now notice we don't stop adding new toolbars because we're up to 30 toolbars and we added 8 task panes in this first version and we continue to add a bunch of other UI components. But the task pane was a new place to start adding features. And by the time we get to the final exhibit in Ye Olde Museum, Office 2003, we added an existing 11 task panes, bringing us to 19 task panes, in addition to 31 toolbars and the IntelliMenus and all the rest of it. So this is how you get from Word 1.0 to Word 2003. And although it looks great on the box when the picture looks like this, in real usage, this is often what Office 2003 ends up looking like on people's computers. Because they don't manage the UI, people don't want to spend time closing stuff, and so toolbars pop up, help pops up, other panes pop up, stuff ends up everywhere, and you end up with this little postage stamp sized place to work in the middle of your document. So, reviewing. The first version of Word had less than 50 menu items. And by the time we got to Word 2003, you can see we're over 250 discrete menu items. And then you look at the number of toolbars and task panes. Well, that yellow line represents the number of toolbars. And remember, every toolbar is not just one command. It's a whole row of 16 by 16 unlabeled icons. So we're up to 33 of those. And then look at task panes. Man, it didn't take long for those to start making their way up, too. So when we started Office 2007, our team looked at this chart, and we're like, where's that blue line going to be? We're going to be at 45 or 50 task panes by Office 2007. And when is this going to end? It was kind of madness. So it wasn't that menus and toolbars weren't a good paradigm. They're actually an amazing paradigm. And it's amazing that things that were invented back in Xerox PARC in the 1970s lasted us all the way to now. But they were designed for less full-featured programs. The feature set of Office has just stretched the limits of what those paradigms were designed to handle. And so as a result, it really is harder to find features than it was a decade ago. It really is harder. Again, remember, menus were designed to support functionality like this. The first spec for sort of menus that came out of Xerox, again, said that menus should have no more than 7 things on it. Well, when you have a program with so much functionality like Office, you can see why my menus are not the ideal paradigm. If this is what your program looks like, where do you put the next control? Right, where does the next gauge go? On the seat? Does it go, you know, on the window? At some point, you're out of room, and so we needed to create a new user interface. And we also thought that this was an opportunity to do what we called reawakening the soul of the software. It was an opportunity to redefine what Word meant and what Excel meant and what PowerPoint meant. It was a chance to rethink the applications, knowing with hindsight how they turned out. What features had we added over time? And so with that, I'm going to do a quick, literally 2-minute demo of Office 2007 to show you a couple of concepts, and just in case anyone in here hasn't seen it before. So this is a Word document here. This is a new user interface. And I've just had some text that I dumped into here. I'm going to make a brochure about Australia. And so the first thing to note is the ribbon, which is the area at the top, which is the tabbed set of commands. And the Home tab is designed to be very familiar to people who've used the standard and formatting toolbars in Office before. So it's pretty simple to, you know, grab some text, click center, and it works very similar to the standard toolbar. We also have something throughout the UI which is called Live Preview, which says that any time you hover over a formatting choice, we'll show you exactly what it looks like, so you don't have to do a lot of trial and error, a lot of click, undo, click, undo, click, undo. In this case, because this is a title for my brochure, I'd probably rather use a style, and in this case, I'll use the title style. Again, see that so these things live preview as well. So let me call that title. And now I'm going to insert a picture. So I click insert, picture, choose this cute koala. And as you can see, this picture inserted itself like pictures always do in Word, and how you hardly ever want them to, which is with the text, you know, sort of displacing the text, and with the text starting down here. So what I'm going to do is use the position gallery, which again just shows you the most common places that people want to put pictures in their documents, and shows you with live preview where it's going to end up. So as I click this one, you'll see that Word scrolls it into view to show me the picture, and I want to give this a cool effect. So these visual things that I've popped down are called galleries, and galleries are the way of showing the results of the feature as opposed to the commands themselves. And they're designed to be very visual, so you can see as I hover over different effects here, I can make it look like a picture, or I can tilt it, or I can give it a reflection, until I find one that looks like what I want to. In this case, I'm going to give it this very simple white frame here. And now I want to format this more like a brochure. So the first thing that I'm going to do here is change the orientation of the page to landscape, again using a gallery, just choose orientation landscape. I'm going to use my live zoom at the bottom to zoom this out to the point where I can see the whole page so that I can sort of get a sense of it a little bit better. I'll split the text into columns. I'll just choose columns, not two. That seems good. Word takes care of the rest. One of the cool things that we've done is even things like margins that used to take going into a dialog box. You can now set the most common margins or the ones that you've used recently, again, just using a very visual, visual thing. Another way that we wanted to make it possible to work is to get the entire UI back for your document. And because all of the commands from Office are put into the ribbon, like there's no additional toolbars and other junk, it's also very easy to get rid of it. So I can right-click and choose Minimize the Ribbon. And now the entire UI has turned into just one little strip at the top. You can continue to access the ribbon in sort of a pop-up mode, but then it goes out of your way to give you a little more space to see your document. And when you're working in this way, one of the cool things that you can do, it's called the mini toolbar. So I'm going to select some text, and if you look just above the cursor, you'll see a little faded-in toolbar that has the most common formatting commands right above it. As I move my mouse to it, you'll see that it fades in. If I move my mouse anywhere other than towards it, you'll see that it's very shy. It just totally goes away. But if I move towards it, I can see the most commonly used formatting commands. So if I want to shrink this down a little bit to make it fit, I can just do that and not even need to use the ribbon at all. So I'm going to bring the ribbon back, and now let's just finish this up. So let's put in sort of a cool header using sort of our gallery of headers here. That's cool. It knew the title of my document today. I can add page numbers very easily, just page numbers, bottom of the page, find a style that looks good. I don't know what I'm in the mood for. Oh, this is kind of cool. So I get a sort of bracketed number at the bottom. And the final thing I'll do here is just add a quick cover page. This looks sort of cool, although this train doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for Australia. So I think what I'll do is just choose Change Picture and choose a nice little picture there, and I'm done. So that sort of gives you a quick overview of how I took some just plain text and turned it into something really cool in just a few seconds, all visually. I didn't use really commands. I just used sort of galleries and live preview to make this thing look cool. So that's the Office user interface. And there's a lot more that I didn't show you. It's really not just the ribbon. I called this the story of the ribbon, but it's more than that. Because there's a whole lot of things that work together to make the user interface work. But really the key concept behind it is this thing called results-oriented design, which is mean as opposed to thinking about commands like execute this command, execute this command, execute this command, we tried to think about functionality that we could put together discreetly and present at a higher level and then figure out how to display it visually. So instead of showing a bunch of commands, show the picture of what it's going to look like and make it sort of fun to play with it. And so people would try different things out, and that would help them learn about the product. So this is the design process that we used, and there's sort of four steps to it. Research, the formulation of design tenets, prototypes, and evaluation. The first one I'm going to talk about is the research that went into it. So whenever I talk about interface design to people at Microsoft, I always talk about it being one part art and one part science. There's no book that you can read that can teach you exactly how to do it because part of it is art, and you need to understand the art part and the science part. Art is all about language for me. User interface is really the language that software uses to communicate to you what's possible. It's the sort of medium between the computer and the human. Now, people have an amazingly emotional experience with a relationship with their computer. I mean, anyone who's ever like slammed a mouse down or, you know, slam their keyboard down, or occasionally you see pictures of people who threw their monitor on the ground. That's emotional. And there's actually some research that was done a couple years ago that showed that Office users spend more time one-on-one with, like, Word and Excel than they do with their spouse, which is sad, but it also shows that this emotional relationship is important. It's something that you spend many hours of your day with. And so we wanted to see how people reacted to Office in their natural habitat, in their workplace, in their home. We ended up amassing 10,000 hours of video of people using Office, people ranting to us, reality show TV where people came up to the camera and said their rants to us. And what we wanted to know is how people felt when they used Office. And all of this data that we amassed ended up getting condensed into something that we call the fish. What's the fish? Well, this is the fish. And we call it the fish because it looks sort of like a fish skeleton. And this is a simplified version of it. But what it attempted to do was take the different sort of indicators that showed when people were unhappy with Office, why they were unhappy. And I'm going to zoom in on the upper left-hand corner, which is called access and user functionality all the time, which is this part. But you can see we also have, you know, people want to feel like they're in control of Office. People want to learn new functionality, and you can see the different importances of those things. But if I zoom into this quadrant, access and use functionality, you can see the kinds of things that contribute to this. Things like, I know I've done this before, but I don't remember how, contributes 21% to people being dissatisfied in this way. The organization of commands changes randomly. That has a 7% effect. And you can see the kinds of quotes that we got. So the fish was our way of taking all of this data and trying to formulate an idea of which were the kinds of things that really annoyed people and which were the things that didn't annoy them as much. And the revelation that we got from all this data was that the sense of mastery of our products was totally gone. That people didn't feel that sense of mastery. Well, what do I mean by sense of mastery? Well, sense of mastery is the feeling that you get when you use a piece of software and you sort of understand what it's capable of. So start with Notepad, right? It's pretty easy to have a sense of mastery of Notepad. It only has 5 menus. Some of those menus only have like 3 things on them. So even if you can't recite all of the features that are in Notepad, I bet you feel pretty confident that you could form an opinion of all the things that are in Notepad. Similarly, the search box in the browser. Although we all know that you know, the search usually can take you to different kinds of features like maps and news, very simple to use, and you feel like you pretty much have an understanding of how you'd get to the additional functionality. You feel like you're the master of it. And early versions of Word and Office, you could have a sense of mastery of. Every toolbar button was also in a menu, and there were only 7 menus, and each of them only had a few things on them. You have that sense of mastery. You control the software. And then there's this. It's really hard to feel a sense of mastery for this. Where do you even look for commands? In the menus? In the toolbars? In the menu of toolbars that you haven't brought up yet? In the task panes? In the list of task panes? It's just impossible to build a sense of mastery of this software. And so one of the reasons that we did the ribbon was so that you had a clear path to click across the top and see where all the commands were. There's only one home for commands. That's what we meant by sense of mastery. So that's the art part of it. And then there's the science part of it. So we have this thing that we internally call SQIM, S-Q-M, but you may have heard of as the Customer Experience Improvement Program. And this is a little balloon that pops up that says, hey, do you want to help make Microsoft products better? We sort of started doing this a lot of years ago, but now almost all the Microsoft, and in fact, other companies are doing this as well. But this is, if you opt in, we collect anonymous, non-personally identifiable data that tells us how you use Office. We've gotten over 3 billion sessions of data so far from Office users. We've collected about 2 million sessions a day, and we collect 6,000 data points. And a data point is like, what are all the commands you've clicked in a day? That's one data point. We have 6,000 of those. How long is your average document? How many emails do you have? How many of those do you delete? How many folders do you have? We have all of this kind of information. And in the old days of doing feature design at Microsoft, here's sort of how it would work, or doing user interface design. Well, I think pivot charts are really important, And everyone that has pivot charts needs to be able to, you know, delete this row at the top level. And someone else says, that's not true. No one needs to delete a row. Everyone just moves that thing to a different sheet. So you're arguing about which button should be bigger. And who wins? Well, whoever has the loudest voice or the most seniority or makes the most elegant argument is just essentially random. Now we actually know. We can tell you which one gets used more. We can tell how commands are sequenced together. So when you use bold, what do you use next? When you use undo, what do you use next? We can sequence commands. We know which ones are used via the keyboard and the mouse. This little thing at the side is a heat map of the old drawing toolbar in Word. And it just is giving you an idea of which commands people use the most. The darker it's shaded, the more people use it. And the less that it's shaded, the least people use it. So now I'm going to actually show you some of the data that we actually used to help make some decisions. So let me minimize this and bring up a couple of these spreadsheets. So I'm going to start with the big mama of everything, something that we call the Office Apps command list. And this is, I pulled it off the server. This is like 1 week of Office 2003 data. And this is the list of every command in Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and Outlook, just sorted by how many times it was used during this time period. As you can see in Word, there's almost 2,000 commands. In Excel, there's 1,500 commands. And some of them is a little misleading. Like here at the top of Word, you'll see that the first command is something called car write MS Word. That thing's actually pushing the right arrow on your keyboard. So Word actually collects things like right keyboard and delete and space that get sort of in here. So you have to do a little bit of tweaking. But it turns out that the number one command in all of the apps, except for Outlook, is paste. Does anyone want to guess what the number one command in Outlook is? Yeah, delete. Delete's used, you can see, 14 million times, and the next most used thing is send at 1.8 million times. So delete's used 14 million, you know, 14 times more than send is. But paste is number one in all of the apps. If you look at Word, paste shows up. The next one is save, that you think of as a command, then copy, and then undo, and then bold. Down here you can see some other stuff like close shows up in the middle of that. And as you go down the spreadsheet, see there's a lot of commands. And you can see some of them get used not very much. Like by the time you're down at people commands that people clicked 6 times, 5 times, 4 times, like see what this thing is. Pyramid diagram stacked chart. So that's someone that took a stacked chart type that was copied from Excel and changed it to a pyramid diagram. Well, 4 people did that compared to the 14 million that hit delete. And there are commands that in fact only get clicked, you know, one time. Like change shape to lightning bolt. One time in this time period, someone took a square and changed it to a lightning bolt. And of course, at the very bottom of this, like unknown control 32847, God only knows how someone clicked on that. We don't even know what it is. We just sort of, we didn't put that one in the ribbon for sure. This is some other cool stuff that we can do. So here's a look at Word data. And looks at commands, and it says what percentage of the time was that clicked via the mouse or a shortcut key like Control-B or Accelerator, which is Alt, and then you navigate the menus with like Alt-EV for paste. And you can look at different commands and say, well, save. Well, we had the argument at the beginning of the release. You don't need to have a save button in the ribbon. That's dumb. People don't use the save button. People use Control-S. Everyone knows Control-S. Well, really? 80% of the time it's clicked in the toolbar. Well, what about undo? What percentage of the time do people use that? Well, 70% of the time undo is clicked with the mouse, and 30% of the time it's used with the shortcut key. Even paste is only done 50% of the time with Control-V, and another 50% of the time it's done with the mouse. And then we could break this up further. When it's done by the mouse, is it the toolbar, or is it the context menu? So you can see there's a lot of subtlety and shading here that goes into sort of forming our idea of the UI. Here's a look at when people are using the Alt key in Excel to navigate the menus, like Alt-EV, which menus are they going to? And you find out that mostly people have memorized Edit, File, and Insert. So if there was a set of them to keep consistent between the versions, those would be the ones that you'd start with. keyboard command length. So this was looking at every single command in the different apps and looking at how many keystrokes it took. This was an old snapshot, like pre-beta 2. How many keystrokes it took to do that with the old version and the new version, and then comparing. Well, this one used to take 3 in the old version. Now it takes 4 in the new version. Well, that's bad, so we should fix that. And we use this to help reduce chords, to reduce the key length of commands in beta 2. And you can see we've marked some ones in yellow that we wanted to go through. In fact, these seem to have missing things in it. But these are all ways that we use the data to help us make informed decisions about how to improve the UI. So the next phase, after all the research, was a formulation of design tenets. So here's how I think about design tenets. So you want to get to that mountain up there. That mountain is what you all visualize is the ideal for us, the ideal Office 2007 UI. We all agree on that. That's sort of our design tenets. Well, how do you get there? How do you get from that house, even though you can see that mountain, how do you know what trail that you take that will actually lead you to the top of that? That, for us, is the design tenets. That's the thing that says, we're going for this mountain. What's the path that we need to take to get there? So does anyone know who this is? Ah, this is Igor Stravinsky, modernist Russian composer from the beginning of the 20th century. And he was composing music at a time when the rules of classical music were changing. And everything was possible. Like, none of the rules of the 19th century applied anymore. He was a modernist. And anything was possible, right? You didn't have any rules. And he was struggling to define what the new rules were. He was the one who wrote The Rite of Spring, which you're hearing now from Fantasia, that was so radical at its first performance in 1913 in Paris. The people literally rioted. The people got up out of their seats and rioted and started the lobby on fire and all ran out. Like, and this is what Stravinsky had to say. He said, I feel a sort of terror when finding myself before the infinitude of possibilities that present themselves. I have the feeling that everything is permissible. If nothing offers me any resistance, then every effort is inconceivable, and consequently, every undertaking becomes futile. He's saying when there's no rules, nothing to help you make decisions, then it's impossible to do anything. You're so awestruck by all the possibilities that exist that you literally don't know what to do. So design tenets are designed to help us make decisions so that it doesn't feel like there's no rules. So we had these 4 goals that actually came from the fish. Making the software easier to use, helping save people time, like making them more efficient, helping people discover more of the power of Office, and help people create beautiful, powerful documents. We felt like if we solved these 4 goals, that we would have a successful UI redesign. And so we had to come up with the design tenets that we felt like if we followed them, would lead us to that mountain, right? This was the mountain. The design tenets were the path to take to get there. And here were the design tenets that we came up with. A person's focus should be on the content, not on the UI. Help people work without interference. Interference for us was Clippy popping up, toolbars popping up, just junk popping up everywhere. Help people work without interference. Reduce the number of choices presented at any given time. This is about contextualization. When there's 1,500 commands in Office, it's impossible to have them all memorized. So you have to find a way of only showing the table tools when you actually have a table up. Otherwise, you'll get swamped. Increase efficiency. We know that if you can improve people's efficiency, they'll react positively. Consistency over homogeneity. Having consistency between Word and Excel is good, but if you don't let Excel be Excel and Word be Word, then they're going to feel unnatural. This was about bringing out the soul of the software. Giving features a permanent home. So this was about there's one place to go find a command, as opposed to smart UI like IntelliJunk that would sort of move the command stuff around for you. This is like there's just a straightforward place for it to be. And finally, straightforward is better than clever. This is a reminder to ourselves not to over-design, that every time we come up with a clever, super-optimized solution, that it would be better to go back to the straightforward thing because no one would understand the super-clever thing except for us. And so this is how we use design tenets again and again. So someone has a design idea. Like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if Clippy came up and looked like you're writing a letter? Well, we take that idea and we validate it against the tenets. We say, well, one of our tenets is straightforward is better than clever. This seems like an awful clever thing, and so we nix it. Right? We did this again and again and again in using the design tenets to help us make decisions. The final thing I would say about these are design tenets have to be religion. If everyone on your team doesn't know the design tenets, can't recite them, then people are going to make bad decisions. And we presented them humorously, we presented them seriously, we filmed me on video in people's inboxes, reading them to them. We did everything we could to get people understanding the design tenets. So when the developer is sitting in his office at 3 a.m. making the code change and there's no designer there to look over his shoulder, that he makes the right kind of decision. That's what design tenets are all about. So then we had the design tenets, we had the research, time to move into the prototype stage. And prototypes, it's like you can do anything in the world. What do you want to do? We created so many prototypes. We have something like 50 or 60 gig worth just of pictures when I was looking through stuff to pick out to show you. 25,000 images alone. We have everything from scratches on the whiteboard, which are gone now, to elaborate flash prototypes. And these were designed to help us look at different ideas. A lot of them were sketches on paper. And unfortunately, a lot of our paper sketches are gone, got thrown away, got recycled. And so most of what I'm going to be showing you is pictures and flash-based stuff and web-based stuff. But don't think that we did it all high fidelity. We did an awful lot of it low fidelity as well. So the first thing we did was conceptual prototypes. And these were designed not to be a full, like, what if you took all of Word and redid it, but like just to explore one specific little concept and see how it felt. And let me show you a couple of those now. So the first one I'm going to show you is called the Configurator. Let me go into full screen mode here in IE. And so the idea behind the Configurator was, what if you had a place that you went where you could sort of configure the way you were going to use Word? So I would say, well, the author of this is a team of people working together. I'm making a report. I'm going to end up making a file and a web page, and I'm going to print it. And you can see, as I choose these different things, of all the features in Word, some of them start to light up. So the idea was that only certain features would be available in each session. And I can say my objectives are reviewing this, and it's going to be for team and public use. And so then when you would go back into your main screen, only the features that you would need from each menu would show up. And as you would hover over each menu item, it would show the relationship of the menu item that you were on to other menu items. So if I went into the insert menu, you can see that for page numbers are related to print layout and page setup and print, whereas date and time is related to a different set of things. And so this was like, maybe you can keep the old menus around, but you can just show the relationship between them a little bit better. That was the idea behind the configurator. Next one I'm going to show you is called fluid menus. And fluid menus were about a feeling. This is about the feeling of not having to click. So in here, all of the UI is off on the side, and you can see it's been split into file, view, modify, add, and review, which I guess at that time seemed like an interesting thing. And these end up being very similar menus to what we have today, except the idea that we were exploring was sort of what was the feeling of exploring, what did that feel like when all you had to do was sort of hover over things to see sort of what it felt like, sort of organically growing UI. Would it make the product feel more simple? This sort of idea of simple, of fluid, excuse me. And this wasn't designed to take all the features in Word and actually rigorously figure out how it would work. It was just designed to put this in the lab and play with it and see how people felt about it. So another one that I'll show you is called the straw man. And so this was one that, again, had menus, and this had some toolbars as well, but it also added an additional thing at the top that was called the parking space, which is this bar at the top. And it was designed to let you get between the different modes of the app. So as you use different kinds of features, more and more things would get added to the parking space, and you could sort of switch between them as you went. So if I like choose the pivot table here, the pivot table tools show up, and I can switch to the pivot table tools, and I can get back to, you know, the main tools as well by clicking up here. It's a little easier to see in PowerPoint, where if I go insert, chart, and say OK, then I get the tools for new chart right here. and I can switch between that and the other things. There's also this weird idea that you could maybe rearrange the menus alphabetically. So switch the menus, and now I've got like A through B menu, C through D menu, and you know this would make it maybe easier to find stuff, and then we'd show you the real menu where it lived over here. This, as soon as someone was like, well, how would you get to help? And they're like, well, duh, that would be in the G through H menu. And you're like, no, it wouldn't. It'd be in Microsoft Office Help. That's in the M menu. We realized that this was not a good idea. But you sort of get the idea. One other cool idea that was in here was the idea that you could highlight unused items. So imagine that you could go through a menu and you could actually see the ones that you hadn't used before that might help you sort of discover all sorts of new things. So those are a couple of the conceptual prototypes that we had. Other just random things that were sort of different than what we ended up with. This was like, well, what if you had sort of menus at the top, but they had sort of full-page UI attached to them, so it actually took the entire screen up to show you stuff. This was something called the ring task menu, which there was sort of a ring that floated around in the upper left-hand corner, and you could sort of go to a space where you would manage all of your features. And so you'd have like an alphabetical list of all of them over here on the side, and you can see your history of when you've used it. And in fact, this is a sort of calendar of all of the days of the week and how many and what features you've used on what days. It's kind of wonky, and I'm not sure that it actually would have been a great direction to go. But this is what conceptual prototypes are all about, sort of trying out random ideas and sort of seeing what seemed good. So in September and October of 2003, there was a lot of fighting. I was trying to think of a nicer word. There's a lot of disagreement within the team about how different a new UI should be. Should it be radically different? Should it be incrementally better than menus and toolbars? Like, what should it really be like? And these were a few of stabs that people on the team took of things that were more iterative, where you keep menus and toolbars around, but you just sort of add on top of them. So here is one in which you keep some of the menus, file and edit and format and tools, but then some other ones move over here into sort of a task pane-like thing where your picture commands are here and the things that go with the picture commands show up below it. I'm not sure that that would have ended up being so great because you have UI on both sides of your screen. This is a little better version of that where you sort of take the menus and you put the toolbar buttons that belong with the menus sort of next to them. So the things that are on the edit menu and the edit commands go under that. And then some of them you... like format, you turn out into a big pain because there's so many formatting commands where you can actually show some dialog box-based content inside of it. Again, a sort of okay idea. So now I'm going to show you the earliest pictures of the ribbon that ever existed. And this was the first one of this is from October 9th, 2003, which is sort of the night the ribbon was born. And I think you're going to be really impressed by this first picture. So basically what we did was we took a blank canvas and pasted in the standard and formatting toolbars and started to draw tabs above them. And it's like, oh, what if you had tabs that took you between the toolbars? Okay, not that exciting actually. But within the hour, we had sort of fleshed it out to something that looked more like this, where, okay, well, you've got some tabs at the top and maybe they're organized around tasks, and you start to figure out, well, what would it take to organize stuff out? Like what kind of layouts would we have inside of ribbon tabs? Would this work or not? The reason this ended up being called the ribbon, by the way, is that the pictures that led up to this, the idea was if you envision like a medieval scroll, like the old style scroll, you had like paper towel tube, and like piece of paper that would scoop between them and you'd like roll it up. That was one of the ideas we had, that maybe you have this thing and instead of tabs, you like roll it to the side to see more of your commands. That was realized would be a stupid idea because you'd have to scroll past like all of the commands to get from like this one to this one. And I happen to call that thing the ribbon. And so then when we did the tab-based version of it, we also called that the ribbon. And it was designed to be an internal code name, and it just sort of stuck. So that's why it's called the ribbon. But by later that night, you can see that we've started to be like, okay, well, you're probably going to need some sort of grouping within the ribbon. So we've started to come up with groups. We called them chunks at the time. One thing that we did throughout the early pictures, I mentioned that we did everything possible to get people thinking about the design tenets. All of the early prototypes we made, we always, when we used Word, we always put the design tenet document inside the picture. So this is what all of our pictures look like, and they actually had my design tenets document inside the pictures, so that everyone that looked at the pictures had to read the design tenets while they were going. It was just another trick to try to get people to read the design tenets. And by the 10th, the day after it, you can see we started to come up with the idea of galleries and integrating the first gallery in here. And this was the first gallery we ever drew, which is like, hey, what if we could put some picture-like things? That would be a better way of showing this stuff than text. Another early, early area of UI we started looking at was UI that's floated nearby the cursor. And the reason for this is something called Fitt's Law. And Fitt's Law, simplified, basically talks about the relationship between how close an object is to your mouse cursor and how big it is to how easy it is to acquire that target. So a huge button that's far away is easy. A small button that's close to the cursor is easy. And then as you move further away or get smaller, it gets harder. So the idea here was if we could put a bunch of UI next to the cursor, then it would be very, very easy to go click it. It would be very simple. And so we started working on different ways of taking UI and putting it sort of around the cursor, and how would that make sense. And of course, this turned into the mini toolbar. We called this floaty at the time. So maybe you can put stuff all around. This becomes a problem because, you know, if you have more than like one line of text selected, then your whole text ends up getting obscured. It pretty much only works when you have three words. This was an idea we had, which is maybe you can defy WYSIWYG, which is to say, imagine if the way that you make room for the floating UI is actually when it's up, you push the rest of the stuff out of the way. We called this the scoocher, which is just like maybe you move everything out of the way to make room for it. And so those were early ideas we had that developed into the mini toolbar. Probably the single most important pictures we drew during Office 2007 was a set of pictures that we drew pretty much 3 days straight. I don't think we left. I remember sleeping on the floor of the office and eating like Bran O's or something, that some box of cereal someone had in their office, but designing this prototype that at the time we were drawing Word blue and Excel green and PowerPoint purple, PowerPoint red, and we decided that we needed to draw a set of pictures that found out whether it was possible to fit all of the commands of an app inside the ribbon. Like, we'd drawn some ribbon pictures, but we had a lot of concerns that there wouldn't be enough, that there wouldn't be enough room, that we literally couldn't fit all the commands we needed to. So we knew we had to pick an app, and we picked PowerPoint to just figure out a place for everything to live, to prove it out. And because we picked PowerPoint, which we did because it has the fewest commands, so if we couldn't make PowerPoint work, we sure as heck weren't going to be able to make Word work. And we called the set Tomato-y, because it was used in a tomato-y red color, because we used PowerPoint. But this is what someone on my team called it, tomato-y. But I read it as Tomatooey. I'm like, why are we calling this set of prototypes Tomatooey? And that just sort of stuck. So they're called the Tomatooey prototypes, and they're pretty much the most important ones. But I don't know why it's called Tomatooey. Anyway, that's a dumb story. But here they are. So Tomatooey was the first time that we took all of the commands and try to find a home for them. So how many tabs do we have to have? 13? 7? 50? We didn't really know. So in this prototype, we accounted for everything that we needed. And you can see a lot of the things that ended up in the product were sketched out even at this early date. So we had the idea of in-ribbon galleries. We had groups. We had insert tab, and we had a slide design tab, and we had a view tab and a review tab. We had this idea that we could show transitions with pictures as opposed to having to use words to describe them. We had the idea that you could bring dialogue box-like content into the ribbon. And this is another example of that. This ended up being a much bigger ribbon than what we ended up shipping. This is a 4-tall-high ribbon as opposed to a 3-tall-high ribbon. But Tomatooey was the prototype that sort of made us believe that the ribbon was possible. See, the quick access toolbar was present even at that point as well. So then there was a lot of discussions about, shouldn't the ribbon be better on the side? Like, why do you put it on the top? Maybe it would be better on the side. And so there are lots of pictures we did of the ribbon on the side. In this case, with the tabs at the top, where you'd click the tabs and they would sort of activate the thing on the side. This works pretty well for Word when it has usually a lot of negative space there. It doesn't work as well in Excel, where the columns are actually more valuable than the rows. Here's another picture of sort of better ribbon content, where we actually have groups very similar to what we ended up with over there. Here's one which is like, you know, maybe you can have sort of big buttons over here, and as you click on them, they, you know, activate sort of more UI, and you can keep like tiling UI on top of it. And then here's sort of the final one where we actually take the tabs totally off the top and put them down here at the bottom. There were two reasons we didn't end up doing the ribbon on the side and we did it on the top. Number one is people felt much more comfortable using UI at the top. Whenever we put people in the lab and watched them use this, people felt very weird about going to the side. It didn't feel natural and it didn't feel like Office. The second thing was my belief that if we had done the UI on the side, it would have devolved into a scrollable list. That it's so easy to solve scaling on the side via like your folder list in Outlook. Here's commands and here's a scroll bar that goes up and down. And I felt really clearly that that was going to be a bad thing, that we wouldn't be forced to solve it. Whereas a horizontal thing at the top, there's no clear way to scale that. And so we'd have to work on the design of it more and end up with something that didn't make you scroll all the time. So that's why we didn't end up doing it on the side at the time. So now we've decided to do the thing at the top. Well, how do we make each tab scale, right? Because that's an issue that we have. How do we make it enough room for stuff? So this was a simple idea called slidey tabs. And this was an idea before groups. You can see it's like you don't have any groups, and what you have are sort of big groups. So here are my picture tools, and then I click here, and this tab sort of slides over to show the next set of stuff. And then I could click here, and this sort of moves across to show the different tabs. That was slidey tabs, not super exciting, and we didn't end up going with that. Another thing that we looked at in terms of scaling was something that we called a dialoguette, very similar to Nicorette, the gum, but not. So the idea here was a bunch of commands have tildes after them. And we thought at the time tilde could be used like ellipses is used to show that something goes to a dialog box. Tilde could be used to show you this is going to bring up a piece of pop-up UI. So here's a command that says nudge, but nudge isn't actually a command. It's a launcher to a dialoguette. And I would click it, and then it would bring up the little commands sort of in place above it. And so I could use, you know, nudge up, nudge up, nudge up, nudge up. And then when I clicked away, it would go away. So that was the idea behind dialoguettes. Ducky labels. So this was in trying to shrink the ribbon down. And it was to say maybe you could get rid of group labels altogether and instead just sort of overlay them over the different parts of the ribbon. And this would also help to sort of enforce the hierarchy of it. And as I move my mouse up here, whoop, they would duck out of the way to expose the stuff that was underneath it. It was kind of cool. We had a good prototype of this, but people were kind of confused by it. So we didn't end up going with that one either. And finally, of this set of prototypes, the Sizzler. And the Sizzler is one of the weirdest prototypes we ever had. It was also the only one that we ever had that had a branding part of it. And the idea here was maybe on all of the, because so much of Office is about formatting. So the idea was maybe every time that you have formatting available, you have this one button that says sizzle. And if you clicked the Sizzler, then it would take over your whole screen and show you lots of different options for how things could look. So this picture could, you know, have a soft shadow, or it could be colorized, and you chose sort of the tools that would go along with each of these. And you could say, I want more like this one, or I want less like this one. And then when it's done, I could click OK, perfect, and I'd be done with it. So that was the Sizzler. We didn't end up going with that, but it had some interesting connotations. So then finally, after we came up with all the weird prototypes, we had to figure out which of them were good. And so that's the evaluation stage. We had so many ways of evaluating the software. We had 3 million beta users. We have the mean stuff people write on blogs. We've got the pleasant stuff people write on blogs. We have paper prototypes, longitudinal usability. We have a thing called the Truman Show, where like one guy volunteered to let us put like 8 cameras around him as he worked like for a month. And he would like, you know, we watched him at all times. We could always tune into the web feed of what he was doing with Office. So we had a lot of different ways to collect information. One of the most useful for us was longitudinal usability. And by longitudinal usability, I mean testing people over a number of months. We found out that people's experience using, especially something like Office that they had some familiarity with, using it in the lab for the first 2 hours doesn't tell you very much about how well your UI is working. It basically only tells you how well it works for the first 2 hours. You really needed to see how people reacted in week one, in week three, in month one, in month three. And that's what longitudinal usability gave us. People that used early builds of the product for months gave us our feedback, and we were able to make a ton of changes based on that. So the single hardest thing that we had to do, I would say, in terms of evaluation, was evaluating feature organization. Now, there are a lot of commands in Office, as you've seen. and trying to figure out how to map all of the 1,000 or 1,500 commands into a new UI was a very daunting task, and it drove some people mad. The first idea we had was writing them all on index cards. This is before we knew there were 1,500 of them, and getting like a conference room and like sort of spreading them out, like which ones sort of made sense. And quickly we realized we didn't have a big enough room on Microsoft campus to do that, and so we had to find other ways. But it's a very tricky thing, because you can come up with something that works really well for one person and it doesn't work well for another person. And so we spent so much time refining and refining and refining feature organization from the very beginning to the very end. In fact, I was just sitting in my hotel room last night. My wife was sitting across from me using her laptop. She's like, "Where's freeze panes in Excel?" I'm like, "Well, where do you think it is? It's on the view tab." She's like, "Why is it a view thing?" Like, "Well, 93% of users believe it should be on the view tab." It's like, "What doesn't belong on the view tab?" Like, "Well, where do you think it should go?" "Well, I don't know, but not on the view tab." So we have a lot of different ways of evaluating feature organization. We looked at things like feature affinity research, which is how do people use sets of things together. We do card sorts, and I'll show you the card sort thing that we use in a second. We look at command loops, which is if you have two commands that you use over and over again, and they're on different tabs, every time it requires an extra click to switch tabs. Like, use this one, switch tab, use this one, switch tab, use this one. So you have to get the command loops eliminated. And the other tricky thing is you always have to get fresh eyes on the product. After you've used something for a couple of months, you're worthless because you already know how it works. And in fact, your beta users are worthless too because they're the same people who now know how it works. So you constantly have to get new people to look at stuff. One of the things we fought early on inside the organization was the sense, like the word team is like, but our commands are already ideally organized. Like, they're already great. I don't understand why you would want to reorganize them. Everyone knows where they are. And so this was a slide that I showed them back in 2003. It's called The Myth of Ideal Organization. Game show. And so what I asked them was, I'm going to show you 9 features in Word. Tell me what they all have in common. So getting the word count, turning on speech and controlling that, creating a SharePoint document workspace, printing envelopes, opening the Visual Basic Editor to do coding, turning on hyphenation, merging documents together, starting web conferencing, tweaking autocorrect and IntelliSense settings. But what do all of these things have in common? Does anyone want to guess? They're all on the Word 2003 Tools menu. So much for ideal organization. What do those things have in common? Pretty much only that they're on the Tools menu. So the thing that we used instead of index cards to find out where how people thought things should be organized was a tool that we called Sortit. And every time people would come into the usability lab for years, the first thing we'd have them do is use this tool called Sortit. And Sortit is a web tool that has a bunch of commands on the left side. So these are all the commands in Word, and you'd go through them one by one. It would tell you what the command does, like background, change the background color. And then here's a possible organization. In this case, we were testing the Word 2003 menus. And then it would create an organization as you'd go. So this was designed when we were doing the Word 2003 menus, just to see how well were people able to predict the existing menu structure. Like, how well did people really know the menu structure? As we went on, we introduced additional organizations, like here's one set of tabs, which things work and which things don't. It turns out that most things have pretty good affinity. There are a few commands that were problematic the entire way through. Headers and footers. 50% of people believe it's an insert thing, and 50% of people tend to think it's a property of the page. And you can duplicate it in both places. That creates confusion because it's like, I know this thing used to be on the tab next to, you know, header, and now it's not there. So there are a couple of tough ones where you just had to make choices. But overall, you know, you could learn some pretty interesting things. Another super interesting thing for us was eye tracking. So this isn't actually like you strap on a huge helmet or anything. It actually turns out if you come into our usability labs, our monitors can watch you. I don't know how that works. I think it involves a lot of expense. But just sitting there, it's like watching your retinas. And it's actually very interesting, because where people look is oftentimes more interesting than where their mouse cursor goes. It helps us to understand Do Japanese users look at things different than American users, right-to-left languages? And there are two kinds of eye tracking we did. So heat map is designed to show overall on the UI where do people look the most. So it's sort of hot where people look the most, and you can see the little green spots where they haven't looked as much. Then gaze tracking, which is sort of a blue line that shoots around, and you get bigger circles when someone stops in one place for a while, like this one here that you see. And then it shows you directionally, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This was someone that was looking at for the bold button and doing quite well at it. Suffice to say, people don't always do that well at the eye tracking. So you can learn a lot from eye tracking. And just for posterity, here's a similar one from an Office 2007 study that we did. Yay, so we feel good about that. So the reason that you do all this evaluation is so that you can do one thing, and this is the most important word in the Office 2007 design vocabulary. This is iteration. We knew that we would have to continually beat the drum, that we'd continually have to revise the product again and again and again as we evaluated. So there's no point evaluating something if you're not going to do something about it. So iteration was super important. And this is how we built it into the product cycle. So for us, it's about you design something, you prototype something, and you evaluate something. Ideally, you can take that green arrow back up to design and just go around and around and around with that, because that's cheaper. But we also knew that we'd have to do the big circle, which is sometimes we would code things and then reevaluate them and have to be willing to go back to the design phase with it, which is to say, if you can't do the short circle, if you can only do the short circle, then you'll miss a bunch of opportunities to fix things once people have the actual product. So we did both of those. And what that required was planning time for iteration into the dev schedule. We knew certain things we'd have to do 3 times to get right. Microsoft has this history of getting it right the 3rd time. And so we figured we better do it 3 times during the product cycle for some things in order to get them right. So we designed an architecture that made it possible for us to make changes late in the cycle. We told people from the beginning, hey, we're going to be making a bunch of changes 6 months before we ship. What would it take to build an architecture that would make that less scary? So here's a case study of some place where we iterated and iterated and iterated to try to get something right. So this is around object formatting, which is like when you insert a picture into the document, how do you format it? So our first thought was, we'll just have a format tab. So that seems to make sense. We'll just put all the UI you need to format all of the objects inside the format tab. So when you have a picture selected, you have all the picture stuff in here. Well, there are 2 problems with that. One is the format tab was constantly changing. So when you had a picture or a table up, it had different things in it, and people were very confused by that. Also, there's a heck of a lot of formatting stuff in Office, and it didn't fit into one tab at all, even when you just piled everything into big buttons. So we ended up with Format 1, Format 2, and Format 3, or trying to come up with different names for them. But it just was clear that that wasn't going to work. And it also violated our design tenet of contextualization. So our next thought was on object commands, which is, okay, get rid of the formatting tab altogether. Formatting stuff doesn't live in the ribbon anymore. Where it actually lives is down by the object. So when I click the picture, we'll bring up all the UI for formatting it right around it. And then I can click these little buttons and I can get to different things right next to the picture. This violated everything, right? It's like now there's another place for commands. Some of the stuff's in the ribbon, some isn't. It also only works when you don't have any text here and the picture's small, and a bunch of reasons that this didn't work. So our next thought was something called immersive experiences. So here's the idea behind immersive experiences. Here's a picture of Abraham Lincoln And if you notice, there's no format tab up here. And when I click this picture, we bring up a little thing that says Show Picture Tools. If I click that, the entire app changes to now become the picture app. So the normal tabs are gone, and a new ribbon shows up for a picture. It's your picture tools. And so now we can have lots of room to show lots of different tabs, so we can show effects and picture tools. And when you're done with it, you can go back to Word. So here you can drop stuff down. I can move this to the top right. And when I'm done with this, I can click away or click back to Microsoft Word, and all the picture tools go away, and then I'm left out. This didn't work because people felt totally confused by it. It's like, where did Word go, and how come a picture app booted? And another reason that it didn't work was, imagine the table scenario. So if I inserted a table, well, what features do you need inside the table tools if it's an app? Well, you certainly need, you know, styles, and you need borders and shading. But you also need bold, and you can put a picture in a table, so you need all the picture tools. Actually, you need all the font tools, and you could be putting data in it, so you need all the data tools. Actually, if you type in Japanese, your entire document could actually be in a table. So it turns out you need all of the features of Word in the table tools, and pretty soon it made it clear that that wasn't going to be a good possibility. So our next try was something called contextual tabs. And the idea behind contextual tabs is, if I insert a picture, that an additional set of tabs, in addition to the main tabs, would show up over to the side. So you'd keep your main tabs. We don't have to repeat all of the font stuff in the table tools. But you'd get additional tabs over here. And at the time, we thought it was important that the main tabs like duck down under it so that it was not confusing you. Later on, we sort of abandoned that. But then I could, you know, still switch back to the main tabs, and then the picture tools would remain available over there. I could switch back to them and come back to the picture tools. So that was contextual tabs. However, those still had a problem. And I'm going to illustrate what that problem was by showing you the oldest living build of Office 2007, which is a build that was called DF4, which was like way pre-Beta 1 build of Office that I managed to dig up. And this is PowerPoint in this case. So it doesn't work all that well. But in this case, I'm going to click Insert, and I'm going to add a shape. Let me draw out a little circle here. I guess that's an octagon. And you'll see that we had contextual tabs implemented. So now we're already at the point where we're coding up all of our ideas. And imagine that I want to change the fill color of this. So I'm going to come over here and choose fill color. And we've got live preview all hooked up. Okay? Well, what we found out is once you have live preview hooked up, people are apt to experiment. And so people experimented with our galleries. And they would hover over the different things to look at it, and then they'd be like, well, fill color isn't really the command that I want. And so how would they dismiss this gallery? Well, they'd just click over here to the side. Clicking over there to the side deselected the shape. Because the shape wasn't selected, the contextual tabs are now gone. And so they go to look at the next button up in the ribbon, and it's gone. They're like, where did my shape stuff go? And we saw this happen again and again and again, because in Windows, when you have a menu up, focus goes, you know, if you click out of the menu, focus goes through. So again and again, we would see people who would be over here using things pop this down. They'd dismiss by clicking here, and all the tools were gone. So that wasn't going to work. So back to the drawing board again. So the next thing we did was something called contextual tabs with something we called eat dismiss clicks. And here's how that works, and I'll show you that by showing you the real product, where we ended up with. So if you remember this document that we were working on earlier, here's a picture, this koala that I was using. If I bring up the picture tools now, and I bring up a gallery, and watch if I click away from it, we eat the dismiss click. We don't send the focus through to the document. As a result, the picture tools remain up, and I can choose, you know, another gallery to look in it. So that's things that we learned over the course of a year of iteration, again and again and again, going through 5 versions. And actually, if I was telling you the real story, there's like another 4 or 5 versions that we did after that to get all of the interaction details exactly right. This is what iteration means to me. Mistakes. It could be that the purpose of your life is only to serve as a warning to others. Don't let this be you. So how does this story end? Well, the attention we put into the Office 2007 UI paid off. We won a number of awards, which is great. And throughout 2007, we've been number one on Office 2007 has been number one on Amazon.com software sales ranks, which is great as well. But that wasn't really the purpose of doing what we did. The purpose of it was to actually reinvent Office, to help solve these goals, make the software easier to use, help save people time, help people discover more of the power of Office, and help them create beautiful, powerful documents. So did we do that? Well, this is a survey that we did of Office 2007 users who used the product for at least 2 months of 4 different countries and of all skill levels, beginner through advanced. And here's what we learned. Green lines are good. Yellow and red are people that disagree with different statements. So around 80% of people say that Office 2007 is more intuitive than previous versions. That speaks directly to our goal of ease of use. Around 80% of people say that the new version requires fewer steps to accomplish what I want to do. That's efficiency, right? Fewer steps equals efficiency. Close to 90% of people say that Office 2007 makes it easier to create professional-looking documents than the previous version they were using. Well, one of our goals was beautiful, powerful documents. And finally, and this is my favorite, 88% of people say that using Office 2007 is more fun to use. And I think what this shows me is that when you restore some of that sense of mastery, that the experience of using the software can actually become more pleasant. It can become fun and not just tedium. And so the way that we did this, our design process, starting with the research phase, in which we learned about the frustrations and the feelings people had when using our product, moving on to the design tenets, the things that ensured that we made consistent decisions throughout the product cycle, all the wild and crazy prototypes, which we came up with tons of ideas quickly and shared them around the team, critiqued them with one another. It's in some ways the most fun part of the product cycle for me. And then of course the evaluation phase, that cycle of gathering feedback and constant iterations to improve our designs, crazy eye tracking, all the rest. I really believe that this design process made it possible for us to improve Office's user interface in a way that we couldn't have done without all phases of the design process. And I think if some of you apply this process to your own products, you may find that you too can help restore some of the sense of mastery to our software. And with that, that's all I have, and I want to thank you very much for coming. And I'd like to invite you to come to the center to ask any questions that you may have and use the microphone so that people who are watching on the webcast can hear your question as well. Thanks.
Hi there.
Hi.
Customization or end-user customization, it seems that it was a fairly deliberate choice to minimize that, and I'm sort of interested in kind of what the thoughts around there were.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with customization, and there were a bunch of things that we wanted to do that we didn't have infinite time to do. And so when we started thinking about customization, the first thing we did was we looked at how many people customized the existing product. So something we heard from power users was that they really appreciated customization. So we looked at the data and found out that less than 2% of our users did any customization at all. And of those, 80% of that customization was 2 or fewer buttons. So what we started by designing was the quick access toolbar, which is a little customizable area that scales very well for adding up to like 30 or 40 icons. And we knew that that would solve, in that case, like 99%+ of usage. That said, when you have 400 million users, 1% of people is still 4 million people. And so there are a lot of people who have given us feedback about customization. And there's nothing wrong with customization. It's something that we may well consider doing in future versions. More customization, I would say. But at the same time, we knew it was most important to get the design right and then add customization on top of it, as opposed to use customization as a crutch, which would then say, well, we don't need to worry about getting the design right because, you know, people just customize and fix it. So there's nothing wrong with it, and I think we'll continue to look at it in future versions. But it was sort of based on the data that we made the design decisions that we did. Hi.
You talked about how what went into the design and of the usability of the Office ribbon. Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, I know a lot of people who read my blog are curious about what went into designing the graphical aspect of the ribbon itself. And I know in Beta 1 and pre-Beta 1, you sort of had the that sort of brushed aluminum fluorescent tabs look, which was dropped for the Beta 1 TR and Beta 2 and so forth. What leads to designing those sort of graphical
I mean, we started with when he's talking about the brushed metal. This was sort of the original brushed metal look. There are a couple things about this design that had us switch away from it. One was that we got some feedback that people felt that it was really depressing. People called it like stormy gray, and like it didn't bring the sort of sense of optimism to the product that we wanted. A second thing was that we wanted to switch the group labels around to be at the bottom, because it turned out that we found through eye tracking that people use the group labels as secondary indicators. They don't read slides and then read font and then look at the button. They read the tab label, then they look for the button, and they use font as sort of the secondary indicator. So we wanted to move that to the bottom, which also necessitated some visual changes, because the idea here was to make the bottom of the ribbon flow nicely into down here. The third thing which we wanted to do to make the product seem less radical in a way was to maintain the blue branding that Office 2003 had. So there was a desire to, from the branding folks, to make it feel a little more similar to Office 2003. So we went back to the visuals and came up with a couple of different designs and found one that seemed good. But it was based on feedback that we got from having this implemented and knowing some of the limitations that it had. But we always look at the Office visuals every release and look at, you know, what should it look like, and I imagine we'll continue to do that in future versions as well.
Hi.
Hi.
One question from Norway.
Hi.
The X question. Why the hell, excuse me, have you put an X on the end of the documents in Office 2007? Everything else is great, but when I shall send an Office 2007 document to a guy that has Office 2003, he cannot open it. That is what I call very user unfriendly. I'm very friendly to you, but I like Office 2007, but I cannot understand why you have done this, I would say, unfriendly way of having all documents not compatible with Macs and other PC versions of Office.
So what he's referring to is that the file format changed in Office 2007, and that was based on the need to have a new file format that's based on an open standard and that is based on XML, which is something that a number of customers wanted. And so that's the default file format in Office 2007. What we did was we built, if you have the most recent service pack for Office 2003 or Office 2000 or Office XP, it can read and write the new file formats natively just as well as Office 2007. And that's also true of the Mac versions of it. But if someone has not, if they just have the CD and has it installed and hasn't updated, they don't have any of the security updates or anything, then they won't be able to recognize it. So our hope is that people update to the most recent service pack of those apps, or in organizations where they have lots of old versions and aren't willing to update them, that they use the old file formats. I'm not the expert on the file format change, but that's sort of my understanding of the process that they went through. But it was necessary to have a file format that was more modern, that was based on XML, because a lot of world governments in the European Union, among other places, have decided that they won't store any information that's not in an XML open file format. And so it was necessary to change from the old binary file formats. But I'd recommend that your friend get the service pack for Office 2003 or 2000 or XP, and they should be able to read and write them just fine. Hi.
Our company writes Windows applications that are aimed at testers and administrators. And when Office 2007 came out, I think our developers got really excited about it. They thought this is the new direction of software. It's a new interface model. And they wanted to apply the ribbon to their applications that they were working on. But do you have any guidance on where you think the ribbon is appropriate versus where is it not the right model for software?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that I would think about in terms of whether the ribbon is appropriate. So one of them is that there's a trade-off with screen real estate, which is to say, if you can get by with you only have 15 commands in your product, then I don't know if it's warranted to, if all you're going to do is just take a toolbar that you have and make them bigger toolbar buttons, I don't think you're actually netting anything out and you're taking up a little more space. So I think it's, number one, a product that either has a lot of commands, and so it can benefit from the reorganization, has a split between menus and toolbars today, or the third thing, which is if you're willing to rethink your product in terms of results-oriented design. Like, as soon as you want to start building some galleries, building some visual representations of features, then you need sort of the space of the ribbon to lay out those things. In terms of the type of thing, we've seen people who use the ribbon for everything from, document editing stuff to process-oriented apps to tools and utilities. I don't think there's really a type of app that suits itself. I think it's more how much functionality it has, and are you willing to take the full leap? Because if you take just menus and toolbars and just take the buttons and put them in the ribbon, it's not going to solve anything. I mean, the ribbon's not snake oil. It doesn't solve anything by itself. It's just a means to helping to solve some problems. The other thing that we did was we took a lot of the UI throughout other places, not just menus and toolbars, in Office, and moved it up into the ribbon to get some of that screen real estate back so that actually net from 2003 to 2007, you don't lose usable screen real estate. One problem that I've seen of some of our partners who have used the ribbon in their apps is they haven't done that. They've kept maybe a toolbar under the ribbon, plus some panes and some other stuff, and they end up with a UI that's sort of even more cluttered than the previous one. So I think it also needs to superset the previous thing that you have. You have to be willing to take some things out to put a new thing in. Otherwise, that sense of mastery is just going to get worse, not better.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi. I was wondering, I noticed in a lot of these prototypes, even the early ones, that the title bar is still there. And you have the file menu, or what became the Office button, is still small and only on one row. I was just wondering if you could provide some insight into how it finally evolved into the final form and why you finally kind of just kicked the file out of there.
Yeah, so we always intended to superset the file menu with something else. And actually, the thing that we didn't know was how far we were going to get along the plans that we had. And so we needed to wait to come up with a final visualization of the feature in terms of what we ended up coming up with. The real reason that we ended up going to the double height thing was a Fitt's law affordance, which is to say if you put this in the corner, that you can easily come up here and just hit the corner and drop the thing down in a very easy way, whereas if it's a tab in the tab row, it's a little bit harder. From a branding point of view, there was a desire to make the sort of start button for Office more similar to the start button for Vista, which is sort of where the visual representation of that came with. But this is an area that I think will, when you see sort of the future of Office, you'll understand more why we made some of the, we didn't just design things for one version. We sort of designed out a couple of versions. So I think you'll get a sense as you see sort of future versions of Office why we made some of the design choices that we did when we did. Okay. But Fitt's Law was part of it, and the branding was part of it as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that this is one of the most, probably the most inspiring talk I've seen in a few years.
Thank you.
I really like your design tenets and what you did with the product. And I wrote a spreadsheet a few years ago, and I have, unlike the gentleman from Norway, I have to applaud your switching to the XML open formats for Office. I think it's fantastic, and it's a great product.
Well, thank you. Hi.
Hello. Do you have any recommendations for people without access to the amount of data you have about your applications?
Yeah, it is a nice luxury, I will say, to actually have that data. I don't think that you need, I'll say this, I don't think that you need all of the fancy data collection mechanisms we have to get your mind around the data. It takes being a little more creative. Like there were some times back when we didn't have a chance to get some of the data that we wanted through usability labs or eye tracking, where we just had to use what we had. Like, I remember being in a hotel at PDC when we first did Office, where we first rolled out Office, and asking the reception staff what they thought about different things and collecting data that way. I remember a time when we looked at people that were getting on a city bus, one of the team members, and asked them when we were actually working on designs for the Office button. We just would go through the bus showing laptops with people and be like, what do you think of this versus this? What are you finding about that? So it's not quite as statistically salient, but you do what you can to be creative about it. Surveys are certainly something that you can do pretty cheaply. There are good and bad things about surveys, but you can learn stuff that way. Look at instrumenting things, especially for web apps. Instrumentation is not, you already have a server. So start to build in that instrumentation layer so you can track clicks and so that you can track what people are doing. It's a worthwhile investment. It actually took us to build all the instrumentation. It took us an entire product team in Office 2003, and it had no customer benefit. Like when you ran Office 2003, there was no benefit to you. But the benefit to you came when we were able to use that data to refine Office 2007. So that was sort of an investment that we made that paid off 6 years after we did it, as opposed to having, you know, just one-off benefit at the time. It'd be great to have all the data, but I think there are some ways to start to build up the sort of scientific rigor around your product. Hi.
Hi. Fantastic talk, Jensen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing. So a quick question is, we mentioned there are so many features in Office. So during your iterative design process, has your team thought about just have a very simple search box for search certain feature? I know that you can go to the help to search it, but just something in the UI.
Yeah, so we have thought about that, and we actually have a prototype that some of our folks in research helped us build, which I think may actually show up on Microsoft.com one of these days. And search is something that is I think, really positive. One of the reasons that we didn't make it the primary way of getting to commands is it sort of creates a second way of getting to everything. And the hard thing is you can do search on command name fairly easily, but most people don't actually know the right command name. So one of the real limitations of the search that we found was that when you put it in front of people, they tended to use search first, and they weren't successful using it because they don't often know what the name of the thing that they're looking for was. So it was clear we would need to add another layer on top of it, another layer of sort of understanding of feature organization to sort of make it searchable. And we just didn't have the time to do that within Office 2007. It's also tricky. One of the problems we had in the prototype was getting it to work other than in English and a few other languages because of the way some other languages, like I think Korean is one that is difficult to search the way that we end up having our commands internally in Office. So anyway, that's a very technical answer for, I think it's a good idea. I think you'll see more of that in the future, but we just didn't do it in Office 2007. But yes, yeah, find would be easier. Yeah, we had a cool, for time reasons, I had to take out a bunch of prototypes. One of the cool ones that I had was called Keyboard Buddy, which was how maybe you could redo the keyboard part of the app to be less about, you know, going through accelerators and stuff, but more about sort of typing what you're trying to do, and maybe that would actually turn out to be fast. On my blog, I'm going to be posting some of this stuff later, and I'll probably get around to posting the Keyboard Buddy prototype as well, since I bothered to get it all sorted out, and I'll talk a little bit about those things.
But last question, please.
Last question.
Hi. I was just wondering if you can explain a little bit about the design process in a bit more detail, what kind of size of group you have, and did you change anything from previous versions in your design approach and design team?
Great question. So Office is split up into two kinds of teams, what we call application teams, like Word, Excel, PowerPoint, that are concentrating only on a certain application. And then we have shared teams. And the shared teams work on features that span all of the applications. And so one of the shared teams is the Office UI team, and that's what my team is. We were about 15 program managers, 30 developers, 30 testers, three or four designers, and two or three user experience researchers. And the Office UI team has existed for years. The thing that we changed starting in Office 2007 is before that time, it was sort of a team for people to use. They would make suggestions. They would say, hey, Word, it would seem to be better if you did that. And Word would say, thank you so much for your feedback. We'll consider that. And then it wouldn't happen. And so the team was staffed up and given the developers to actually make the changes in all the apps and the authority to make those decisions stick. We actually did the command layouts for Word, Excel, and PowerPoint and Outlook. We actually, you know, not to say that we were dictators, because we obviously listened to the suggestions from the, you know, we're partners with the Word team and the PowerPoint team, and they had great, and they know their customers better than we did. So it was a partnership. But in the end, the difference, I think, was that we had final cut. And sometimes that caused some consternation, but it meant that we could make the thing feel like it was designed with one voice, by one person, even though it was sort of one team. So that's the biggest thing that we changed. It becomes increasingly hard for that to scale out, because even Word, Excel, and PowerPoint is a lot. If you had a substantially bigger suite of applications, you know, it might be even harder. So it was also important for us to make sure that the people on the Word team knew the design tenets and the PowerPoint team knew the design tenets, so that we weren't the only ones that were sort of the keeper of the important information. But that's sort of the size of our team. That's how we change things. I've only worked on this team since Office 2007. So I joined right at the beginning of this process. And so I wasn't there in the olden days, but I understand that it was frustrating at times. So, okay. Thanks much for coming, everyone.